And now welcome to the Midday for a Thursday. I'm Norman Gilliland, once again in our Buck studio, where we're going to be hearing some illustrations today of a couple of pieces in the big sense of the word, that are going to be performed this weekend by the Madison Symphony. The two being Leonard Bernstein's Serenade, inspired by Plato's Symposium, which is worth several hours of discussion in its own right, but we'll unfortunately not have that much time to devote to it. We'll have some musical examples from it, though. And then also on the program, Beethoven's Symphony No. 9, the great sprawling choral symphony. And who better to talk about those two pieces than the conductor and the concertmaster of the Madison Symphony, John DeMaine and Naha Greenholz. Welcome back to the Midday.
Thanks for having me, Norman.
This Bernstein Serenade is a work that's very intellectual, I guess you could say. I mean, based on these individuals from, literally from Plato's Symposium, characters, Greek individuals that most of us have probably never even heard of, mm-hmm. and yet somehow Bernstein is representing them musically. Is that what's happening in this five-movement serenade?
Yes, I think there's each of the movements has one or two speakers as their title, and it's loosely based on some of the themes that they espouse in their speeches.
But when you say speakers, you know, do you mean actually speakers, or do you mean musicians representing the thoughts of these individuals?
Oh, well, the speakers from the symposium, so Phaedrus, Socrates,
right.
et cetera,
yeah.
those are the names of the movements. And for instance, the first movement, we open with a speech by Phaedrus in praise of Eros, the god of love. And you can hear that very clearly in the violin line.
Can you, really? And what does that sound like?
Well, it's there are some clues as to the intent, Bernstein's intent. And so, you know, at the beginning of the piece, you have all a mess of Italian words like
could you be less technical?
Molto legato, senza portamento, which means without slides. And he also says simply in English. And so that suggests a very rhetorical kind of unfolding. And so even from the first bar, you can hear Bernstein's trademark. This is the opening. This particular tritone that resolves up.
Maria.
We can hear that from West Side Story. So that's the very opening. And so the solo violin has a line. And the material for becomes the material for a fugato, which means that the first violins come in. You'll hear that with John on the piano with the same material. And then the violas come in. And it's very spacious, speech-like unfolding. And then the second violins, violas, and cellos kind of propel us into the new character with the same material. So he has kind of outlined that part of the movement is Pausanias' speech, and that's where he speaks about the duality of the lover and the beloved. So we can start by playing a little bit of
sure.
that.
That's a great one, and you can hear that little motif resounding
Absolutely.
Throughout that. When either of you, John DeMaine or Naha Greenholz, get to a piece like this, Serenade, do you find it necessary to really read up as much as possible the kind of the intellectual underpinnings of it, or do you think you could ever just look at the score and nail it?
Oh, I think you can look at the score and nail it, because he says that it's not programmatically composed.
Ah, so, okay.
You know, and he says that in the in his opening statement about the piece, that there is no literal program for this serenade, despite the fact that it resulted from rereading of Plato's charming dialogue, The Symposium. So it gives him, you know, the thing that I find is the next excerpt that we're going to play is reused several years later, 3 years later in Candide. Uh-huh. You know, all through All Night Long, this little theme is used in transition. So he reused his own music.
About as different from Plato as you could get.
Exactly. But I think that what I like, you know, we knew that Lenny was fascinated with puzzles, all kinds of intellectual games and puzzles. So what I think is interesting about this piece is that there are gorgeous moments in this piece and very emotional moments in this piece. But at the same time, he's always got a little puzzle going on.
How so?
Well, there's at one point, Naha plays a cadenza with the principal cellist, and they're in two different keys. You know, and then these sort of, this fugato and this sort of tossing around. I mean, here he puts us in seven sharps. And
yikes.
Puts every, you know, mm-hmm. And
how is that for you, Naha?
It's interesting to find the tonality in that. And also, the word that he uses in his own preface to the work is evolve. So he sees the piece as using germs of ideas from previous material and evolving that throughout the piece.
So he's actually consciously or overtly doing that.
Yeah, and also by the end, you know, he goes into his other trademark, which is jazz.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a kind of exuberation that he finds, and isn't that the one where they're at a dinner party and you know,
exactly.
And he's just figuring out that there's probably going to be wonderfully animated conversation at this dinner party. Yeah. So he sets it as a wonderfully animated dialogue between all the players and breaking out into a really jazzy.
Absolutely. I imagine that it's the kind of dinner party that you would find him at.
Yeah. Well, as soon as you said that, John, I thought, yeah, okay, this sounds like Bernstein, all right. So what's this next piece then, the next excerpt you have?
We'll play a little bit of the second movement, and so this is Aristophanes.
Aristophanes? Is that
Aristophanes.
One? No, the
yes.
Playwright? Aristophanes, yes.
My mm-hmm. Greek is not up to par here. And he's not playing the clown, Bernstein says. He's extolling the fairy tale nature of love. And so this one is very, John played a little bit from this theme already, but this theme moves in steps. So we have, which is different from the first theme that we heard. And then inverted, those notes, but backwards. So,
oh, that's another puzzle there, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it gives a very rocking and lilting, reassuring kind of interpretation of love.
Lyrical quality to it. How about if Bernstein had written this for any other stringed instrument or any other instrument for that matter, as opposed to the violin? Would it work as well? Was there a specific reason you think he chose the violin to express these personalities or these ideas?
Well, it's about love.
good point. Okay, that's about all you need to say, isn't it?
I can't imagine the trumpet.
The bassoon might be a problem.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And not only that, you know, this piece is for violin and string orchestra, and then it's underpinned with some delicious, you know, accents in the percussion mm-hmm. and harp. But it's a string piece all the way around that he's found his vocabulary.
Mm-hmm.
It's always interesting to hear what one composer has to say about another. We'll get to Verdi talking about Beethoven's choral writing in a moment. But in the meantime, back with John DeMain and Naha Greenholz and the serenade based on Serenade After Plato's Symposium is the title for solo violin, strings, and percussion. Five-movement work written in 1954 by Leonard Bernstein and illustrating, in a general sense, these five characters to be found in Plato's Symposium. Sounds like a tall order, and yet you two have made it sound like it's not so out there after all. Mm-hmm. Well, what else do you have here to illustrate what Bernstein is up to in this serenade?
Well, I want to save a little bit for the concert, so I'll just...
That's fair. A little bit of yourself, you mean.
Right.
It strikes me as not being a pushover for the violinist, just from the excerpts you've played.
Right. It's a full-on concerto, for sure. The third movement is very tricky, actually, for both soloist and orchestra. Some of the tricky stuff in the violin solo is echoed in higher octaves in the first violins, and they have strength in numbers, so they're covered there. But so the third movement is a really fast exchange, and then the fourth movement has some of the most beautiful Bernstein melodies I think he's ever written. And so we'll save that for the concert. We'll play a little bit of the fifth movement, and it opens with Socrates describing a visit to a seer, and as John kind of hinted, there's a love duet. It's a tortured one between principal cellist, who will be Carl for this concert, and
Carl Levine.
And the violin, tortured, illustrated being in two different keys. And then he's rudely interrupted by a band of revelers. And so we get into a really rollicking series of party music, basically, jigs. And we have a little jazz thrown in. At the end of the next excerpt we're playing, you'll hear the plucked jazz solo from the principal bass.
You know, what I thought was kind of interesting is when he says, if there's a hint of jazz in the celebration, I hope it will not be taken as anachronistic Greek party music,
right,
but rather the natural expression of a contemporary American composer imbued with the spirit of that timeless dinner party.
Sounds fair.
He can do what he wants, right?
That's right. Poetic license. A taste, an hors d'oeuvre, you might say, that dinner party. But it is fun stuff, and it certainly has Bernstein's fingerprints all over it, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
All over it. Well, which is great because, I think with Lenny as a composer, everybody was saying, well, did he have his own voice because he was writing for Broadway and he was doing
sure.
all these different things. But when you look back on his toys that he uses, his tools of composition, he has his own sound, and it just becomes
absolutely.
More and more...
Yeah.
He said that when he would set the summer aside for writing, it would take him a month to get Mahler and Bruckner and everybody else out of his brain and try to get back to him.
After conducting, you mean?
After conducting all
sure.
year long,
yeah,
he had all this music of other people in his brain, and he had to get that out and try to get back to him.
Mm-hmm.
But I love his music. I think it's just great.
Yeah. It's always, fun to play a new composer, and it's always an honor also to play with John, who has a personal connection to Bernstein, so it's been
sure.
a really fun
yes.
week.
Yeah, I'm sure the stories are legion.
Outrageous man, but brilliant. You know, what was so interesting to me is when he put his serious musical hat on, it just blew you away. I mean, he had just an enormous brain, enormous capacity. And the other thing, with all the stories and all of his personal life and all that stuff, What the other thing was is the great spirit of positive energy that he worked in, you know, and which is why people seemed to always play better than they could play with him. Rather than intimidating, he made you better, and he built you up, which I think is a sign of a great person.
That's true, whether it's a conductor or a director of a film. Same thing.
Exactly.
Bring out the best in the player.
Absolutely.
Exactly. What prompted you, John, to pair this Bernstein Serenade with Beethoven's Ninth? Probably the first time it's ever been done.
Well, you know, maybe the first time it's ever been done, but it's certainly, we know that Leonard Bernstein had a big affection for Beethoven and, of course, conducted the big concert, you know, when the Berlin Wall came down.
Right.
And he always has, you know, he was a very political man as well as a great musician, and always was very liberal in his political philosophy. But I thought that also, you know, the Beethoven Ninth is a great outpouring of a symphony about love as well. You know, I mean, that all men are brothers, and
yes,
and loving under the the God of the universe. And so I think that while the symposium looks more at maybe different aspects of personal love, the Beethoven looks at aspects of universal love. And also, I just like the idea of the stark contrast of a 20th century composer with the music of, was that 1824, the
yes,
first to performance. So we're getting close to a 200-year-old symphony.
Well, of course, can't go too far wrong with it as a season finale either.
No, well, that the idea of programming the Beethoven Ninth was generated because of it's the 10th anniversary in Overture Hall. And we played the Beethoven Ninth to open Overture Hall 10 years ago and closed with the Mahler Eighth. And so this time we thought we would play the Beethoven Ninth as a celebration.
So about the choral writing in Beethoven's Ninth, first of all, of course, it confused a lot of people in Beethoven's time, as his later works did, but this sort of violent yoking together of a symphonic work with a choral work, and even people after Beethoven's time had some negative things to say about this.
Yeah, but since then, we've had, you know, the Mahler Eighth, we've had the Mendelssohn Lobgesang, you know. I mean, we've had, this was
sure,
the first. And this fourth movement, after these first three movements, which are long and gorgeous, the fourth movement is like a symphony unto itself. So it's an event, both for the audience and for the players. But it poses some interesting challenges.
Well, and we have Beverly Taylor, who's going to be conducting the Madison Symphony Chorus for this. Now, John reminded me off mic a while ago that one of the people who had some things to say about this work was Verdi, who said, what was the word? That was just plain bad choral writing?
Bad vocal writing.
Bad vocal writing.
Just very mediocre vocal writing. After praising the first three movements with great, great praise, but he just thought he didn't know how to write for the voice.
Well, do you have any insights you can provide, Beverly, as being the one responsible for the words in this? What would have prompted Verdi to say such a thing?
Well, first of all, everything lies high, what we call the tessitura, where the majority of notes are per part. And the bassing up to tenor range and overlapping, and the tenors overlap alto range, altos overlap soprano, and the word is sopranos have to come from the angels of God because it's just high, high, high. It's exciting to sing, but when you're singing that high, it's hard to pronounce the words. So you either make enough tone to be heard over the orchestra and have hard to hear words, or you have great words and blood is pouring out of your throat because you can't produce them that high. So most of us who prepare the chorus for this work have some tricks, and it involves basically lots of doubling. So every time anyone is an exposed part, the bass is, say, you're throwing a few tenors on and others. I have a... Should I do tricks of the trade, or do we hide this, John?
No, you can do the tricks
things
of the
like
trade.
You heard it here.
I have da-da people, so when we're singing Ah, Lamentation, all mankind or all
yes,
humankind, it comes out very strong. Well, with an orchestra, ah has no punch, so I assign about 20% of the singers to sing da-lamention. Believe it or not, it's like cooking wine that disappears in the cooking.
Uh-huh,
the
uh-huh,
D is sucked up by the orchestra. You don't hear the consonant,
sure,
but it gives much much more point. So we have to do things like this, which I don't know if we did it in Verdi's day, but it's quite right. I mean, the Verdi Requiem's hard to sing, but it lies very well up and down in good parts of the range. This is exciting to hear, but it's exhausting.
You know, I've seen contemporary composers make the same mistake where they're writing always in the extreme of the singer's range. You know, if you look at the Verdi and Puccini, who wrote so well for the voice, the high notes are intermittent.
You give them a break. Yes.
But when you look at this in the last movement, this is in the vocal line, but then it's repeated in the choral line. Yeah, so you have you know, it's just too much. It's too much, and so after a while, it's really hard on the throat. But he was deaf, right? I mean, he wasn't thinking about that. He was thinking only about.
Or it could be what Charles Ives did, writing for theoretical things. Some of the time, and we have to make the ideas happen by making adjustments. And the singers love to do it. They always are excited by it, and they go home and rest between performances for sure.
And it's so fast. You don't even have time to prepare sometimes, you know. So when you're doing.
That's the hardest section, actually.
I have to. Be sure to say here that John DeMaine is the conductor, not a member of the chorus for this performance, in case you weren't aware.
If I'm conducting,
it's because John has fallen ill, but that doesn't happen. I'm prepared to go.
I foist my voice on the orchestra as little as possible, but sometimes it just helps to sing things as a conductor, right?
Sure.
But that's way out of my range.
Well, it's a fascinating insight that you've given us into Beethoven's Ninth and the difficulties behind it, but of course, always a crowd pleaser these days. Well, thanks everybody for stopping by and giving us some insights into the three performances that the Madison Symphony is going to be providing this weekend: Friday night at 7:30, Saturday night at 8, Sunday afternoon at 2:30 at the Overture Center in Madison. It's the Bernstein Serenade after Plato's Symposium, and it's fascinating thinking to link them together. Beethoven's Choral Symphony, the Symphony No. 9. Thanks, everybody, for stopping by and giving us some excerpts and some insights.
Thank you, Norman.
Thanks for having us.